This is a recording of the silent lecture from April 13th. The lecture deals with the radio function for the orbitals of the hydrogen atom and the interpretation that goes along with it. Then it deals with angular momentum quantum number, magnetic moment, and magnetic quantum number. All right, so we are on the PowerPoint that deals with atomic and quantum mechanics, and the slide that you see on screen after a few minutes into the lecture is slide 18. Slide 18 shows us the interpretation of shells, which is, so to speak, an artificial exploiting of coincidence. It has to do with the radio functions. So if it's not shown in this lecture, but if you go back one slide to slide 17, then you see the solution for the radio functions that must have been introduced in the last lecture. And take a look at the equation on the top left. So after the separation of variables, we had psi equal r times y of theta and phi. Theta and phi we already solved before, and we found these shapes that everybody associates with electron orbits. Then remained to be solved the radio function, which you see on the left side of slide 17 in the lower panel. It's a partial differential equation. If one solves it, one gets a series of solution functions for all the various orbits, indicated by their quantum numbers n and l in the index. For instance, and this is on the right bottom part of lecture slide 17, R10 means we do n equal 1 and l equal 0. There's of course no other 0 because l is bounded by n, and it has a dependence on radius rho, e to the minus rho, and times some constant that comes out of a normalization process. R20 would be the 2s orbitals radial distribution, and it also depends on e to the minus rho, but times 1 minus rho times some normalization constant. And if you glance down further, there's also an R21, because there can be an angular momentum that is not zero for the p orbitals. And in that case, this turns into rho times e to the minus rho times a constant. So the interpretation of that now is what we're thinking about. Before we quite go there, I want to go further, actually forward in this case. Let's see which slide I'm having in mind. Slide 25 will do. On slide 25, you see probability clouds for the shape, top left figure, for the shape of the 1s, the 2s, the 2p, the 3s, and the 3p orbitals as examples. And then in the remaining figures to the right and to below, you see further orbitals like d and f orbitals as well. So I'm not sure whether I talked about this in an earlier lecture, so we'll do it right now. Look, for instance, on slide 25 at the 1s orbital. So this gives me, why is it printed in dots? Because this is a probability picture. So it's a spherical geometry, but it doesn't always exactly look the same inside. The spherical geometry just tells me that the electron is somewhere in that sphere. And even that is not quite true, because one has to consider the probability with which one wants to find an electron inside a sphere of a given size. So, for instance, the one that is drawn in the figure for the 1s, it's a certain radius, and typically one draws either the 95% probability amplitude or the 70% one, but one can draw all kinds of other probabilities. So assuming that this is a 95% one, one would then get a much larger sphere if one were to go for the 99.999% probability sphere. So 99.999% being the probability to find the electron in that space. And the spherical nature just says there is no particular direction in which it's more probable to find it than in the other. But now glance over to the 2s orbital. It's actually a ring, and three-dimensionally that would be a hollow shell. And in that is another sphere that's occupied. That's where lots of dots are. And in between, there's a lot of space where there is almost no dot or maybe no dot at all. Whether there are dots showing up somewhere in that gap depends on which probability one actually draws. And based on what I see there, I'm starting to think this is not the 90%, but maybe the 70% picture. So the occupancy within different distances of that overall sphere, that is what the radio function contributes. Slide over one more to the right, then you see the 2p orbitals, and here you see actually why this choice of probability that one wants to draw for the orbitals matters. You've probably before seen orbitals that look different, more cigar-shaped than these separated spheres. That's what the 2p really looks like, right? On top, there's one drawn for the y-axis and on the bottom for the x-axis, or vice versa, depending on how you draw your x and your y in there. And so that, actually that's a z at the bottom, I can tell from the quantum number. And then the x and y are equal. So what is that all about? Why do they look so strange compared to what we used to look at? Well, because if I have a non-spherical distribution and I play with the probability, then the shape of the orbital actually changes. In the picture with the black background and the orange and blue distributions to the right, you can see a lot of orbitals. And in the top row, n equal 1, 2, 3, 4, up to 7, you see alternating rings of the same nature of s orbitals of occupied and unoccupied space. And you see that this radial distribution that is behind it is ever more complicated. So now that we have some sort of idea what it is that we want to describe, let's now go back to the slide with which your lecture actually starts, and that's slide number 18. So we have learned in one of the last lectures to calculate, and I did two examples, I think 1s and 2s maybe, to calculate those functions from the table. And because the normalization was slightly different in our lecture and what's shown on slide 17, they look a little bit different, the formulas. There's basically a redefinition between R and rho involved that I didn't comment on. It doesn't really matter for us. It's producing the same function. It just has different constant multiplied on because the R has been expressed as a form of generalized radius rho. So when we calculated that, we got the 1s result, and so the probability now plotted, not the r, but the r square, produces now a zero probability at r equals zero. R, of course, being the axis on the horizontal. So the 1s function is different from the 2s, the 2p, and all the other ones, in that it doesn't go in the same way to zero at r equals zero. R equals zero is, of course, the place where the nucleus of this atom resides. And it's a tiny, tiny fleck a speck. It's just a ten thousandth or so of the diameter of the atom is occupied by the nucleus. So if you consider the whole range of all the orbitals, including the 3D, it goes out to something like 16, 17, 18 times the Bohr radius. So take 1/10,000th of that, then even when you're at the one Bohr radius, which is the one that is indicated on the x-axis of the 1s plot, then you still have to go about 1,000 times finer on that axis before you actually see the spot that is the nucleus. And all these other functions, 2p, 2s, and so forth, they all have a true zero there that they have asymptotically approached. But the 1s function drops more dramatically and sharper. And so there is a small range inside the nucleus where this 1s electron can actually be. And that makes it special compared to all the other orbitals. It can literally meet and communicate with the nucleus and carry that information outside. That is not really of concern in our lecture, but I want to mention it because there are a lot of sophisticated, more advanced effects that are based on that, and here's a good place to introduce that idea that the 1s electrons can be special compared to all the other ones. What else do we see? We see an almost Gaussian distribution for the 1s, but a little bit distorted to the large radius side, so it's not fully symmetric. It folds slower to the large distance from the nucleus than it folds towards the nucleus to the inside. The peak, however, is exactly where the Bohr model, the more primitive model of the hydrogen atom, would have put it. Because the axis where the 1 is, you see the axis is actually listed on the slide at the very bottom of that figure, is in radius per Bohr radius. So when the radius is equal to the Bohr radius, then we have a 1, and that is exactly what we see for the 1s. So on average, that's what the peak means, the average, on average, everything is actually for the 1s in the hydrogen exactly like the Bohr theory describes. And that's the main reason why one still holds on to first teach the Bohr model before one actually goes to the quantum mechanical calculations. Now take a look at the distances at which all the other distributions peak, and pay heed to that the numbers in the various plots rescale with regards to where the one Bohr radius is. For instance, for the 2s, the one Bohr radius is actually where that secondary maximum, the tiny one, close to the origin, where that is where the one Bohr radius is. But there is a much bigger peak for the 2s at about 5.2 Bohr radii. And there's also mentioning of 4 Bohr radii. That's where the maximum probability of the 2p happens to be. So now, if you think of it in terms of chemistry and the periodic table, one always talks about these specifically stable elements known as the inert gases. That has to do with this mild overlap of the 2s and the 2p probability maxima. And you see that in the insert in the figure on the top right on this same slide. So there we have now just the radius with the maximum probability drawn, and even drawn as a range. So for the 1s, it's that ring, the one that's labeled n equal 1. For the n equal 2, that will be the 2s and the 2p, we get now this range from 4 to 5.2. That is the thickness of that ring that is shown there. And for the 3s, if we just look at the largest probabilities, they range from something like maybe for the 3D, 7 or 8 Bohr radii to something like 14 or 15 for the 3p and 3s. where the probability is really, really high. So that would be that wider ring in the top right figure that goes from somewhere around 8 to maybe 13 or so. So they have really drawn out only from maximum to maximum. Okay, so now this coincidence of overlap starts to look like the electrons in the 3 state, n equal 3, are almost always between 9 and 13 Bohr radii distance from the nucleus. The one in the n equal 2, the 2s and 2p, are almost always between 4 and 5.2. And the one is almost always at 1 Bohr radii. Okay, so that coincidence is now what is called shells, because literally we have drawn it like shells, hollow spheres, right? Because it's all three-dimensional in reality, not just this 2D plot-like. And we see that... Okay, that starts to look like actual having some meaning, because the electrons are always there, and so one can call that a shell. The stability simply comes from the fact that if you now have packed for a particular atom, so obviously not the hydrogen where we just have one electron in the 1s state, not helium where we just have two electrons in the 1s state, not lithium where we have two electrons in the 1s and one electron in the 2s, not the next one, not the next one, not the next one, but when we have packed all of the threes full too, then we're in the third row at the end at the inert gas. And from memory, I would say first one is helium, second one is argon, so that's probably xenon, although we don't have to speculate because at a later slide I actually have the elements listed. So if I quickly go down there to just check. Oh, I don't have it listed. Oh, cool. I was wrong. I forgot the neon is the second, argon is the third. So by the time we have filled the 3Ds also all full, we are at argon. And if we wanted to add another electron, then we would have to add the four radio functions, 4s, 4p, 4d, and 4f. And those, in the same spirit as the ones, the twos, and the threes, make another shell, but at a larger distance from the nucleus, and that costs more energy to build that. And so adding just one electron to an inert gas, that's why it costs more energy, because you have to make a stable orbit at a much larger distance. It's similar to when you want to launch a satellite that is at a large distance from the Earth in a steady orbit, compared to one that's at a small distance from the surface of the Earth, it costs more fuel to bring it there. Okay, so that is what we have on this first slide. And how long in the lecture does this go on? Let's see. I have to take a quick peek here. Yeah, so at 12 minutes 20 seconds I've shown that same slide that shows the shape of the orbitals that I already talked about, so we are done with that. Then down to something like 19th minute or so, I'll go back to the slide that we have just been talking about, and then I jump back and forth still a few more times. So let me see. And at about 27 minutes, 40 seconds, I now start to write something down, chapter 9. And what I've written there is another new property for electrons. So far we have successfully described N and L quantum numbers. But it turns out that's still not it. There's still more. And so at 29 minutes, I now write down angular momentum And there are two types. There is the orbital angular momentum and the so-called spin. Now, orbital angular momentum one can envision in terms of the Earth angular momentum. The Earth has also two angular momenta. One is from the elliptic path about the Sun, where the spinning center is pretty much at the center of the Sun. So one has an angular momentum with respect to that. That's called the orbital angular momentum. And then the Earth also rotates about itself, its own axis, day and night, right, that rotation, and that is akin to the spin angular momentum. It's named after this are the orbital and the spin angular momentum of the electron. However, the real physics of this is completely different, because the electron is not in a simple orbit that's like a circular or elliptical orbit. It fills these clouds with probabilities. Probabilities means that it doesn't even follow necessarily a specific path. It just surfaces, shows up at these different locations and distances from the nucleus with certain probabilities. That is all we can say about it. And that amounts, because of the shape of the overall orbit, to something like an average orbital-like angular momentum. So what I'm doing now in lecture, 29 minutes, 20 seconds, I've written down what torque was, and torque is what gives us access to angular momentum. Torque was R cross F. And in classical physics, I usually explain that by doors turning about their hinges. If you think about pushing a door open, it's already unlocked, and now you want to turn it, then you push on the handle with your arm in some direction, maybe 90 degrees to the door plane, or maybe at some angle to it. It doesn't matter. You can open the door either way, but the efficiency of your push in terms of creating rotational motion will be different if you change the angle. That's what the cross product is about. So the R vector would be the vector from the hinges of the door to where the force acts. That would be where the door handle is. And make a cross product with that direction to the force vector with which you're pushing, whichever direction your forearm makes with regards to the plane of the door. It could be 90 degrees, it could be some other angle. It makes a difference, and the cross product tells us that the efficiency of this torque, which is the equivalent of force in the rotational mode, the amount of force that actually creates rotation, scales with that sine of the angle between these two vectors. And so you see that for 90 degrees, you would get the highest efficiency for opening a door. Now, in that same sense, but with its completely different physics, the electron in its orbit understood as this strange quantum mechanical probability cloud, depending on its location, experiences now a torque. All right, let me see where I continue writing. Okay, at 30 minutes, 30 seconds, you can now see that the torque is the rate of change of angular momentum. And so that is how the torque leads to this new vector, and this angular momentum is actually rate of change of torque is angular momentum. Yeah, so this torque is actually our gateway to finding this thing, this new quantity that like the regular momentum, possesses a conservation law. That's why it's relevant, so one can write down conservation laws. All right, let me maximize my screen here a bit, so hopefully I can read the next thing then. Yeah, I'm now at 32 minutes 43 seconds, and I'm trying to read what I wrote there. In the apostrophes, that's clearly self-rotation, that's what it says. So the spin is, in that same sense as the Earth spinning, an analogy of the electron spinning about itself. It's really a bit more complicated than that, but right now it's good enough for us to think about it in this way. And so, let me see when I move on to the next point with this. Now I'm still explaining the rotation of the Earth and the rotation of the electron about themselves. Maybe I'm getting close to the end of the lecture here. So do I get anywhere else? Yeah. So at 43 minutes 55 seconds, now I've written down something with consequences for the quantum numbers. I've introduced the L vector L, for the orbital angular momentum, and the vector S for the spin angular momentum. And they are both vectors that do not point in general in the same direction. So one can do vector addition to define a new vector J. And now the twist to compared to classical physics is that the L vector and the S vector, the angular momentum and the orbital and the spin angular momentum, are both quantized, can only take on discrete values, and their values can sometimes add to each other and sometimes subtract. And in the total, it makes a quantized J vector that itself is not a physical property, but it consists of these two physical properties. And how does it now quantize? I write that down at 54, 53. The magnitude of this L vector, based on our already introduced quantum number L, is quantized in multiples of h bar, the h over 2 pi, in the form of square root L times L plus 1. So that is typical for all of these angular momenta. And at 4603, I have completed this thought. So the L quantum number starts at 0 and goes in integer steps, plus minus 1 and so forth, at which it can vary. The S quantum number will be square root of S times S plus 1 times h bar, is the spin quantum number. And so it works in just the same way. And it turns out that something like an electron, but also something like a proton or a neutron, always possesses a spin number of 1/2. So these are half integer values. And it, in the case of 1/2, there are only two possibilities how that can point. One calls them usually up and down. It's a little bit of an oversimplification, as you will see a little bit later in this or the next lecture. Really, there is an angle so that the spinning vector actually sweeps out the surface of a cone. But on average, therefore, averaged over a rotation of that cone, it just points straight up or straight down, depending on whether you make an upward or a downward cone. Okay, so let's see how much further I get here with this topic. I think it might be almost it for today, although I'm not quite done yet. Yeah, I'm already at 48 minutes, 20 seconds. Yeah, there's one more thing that I add, and that is top right of the whiteboard, the calculating the magnetic moment is becoming the name of the game, if you like. Again, there is a review of physics 1220 where we first meet angular momentum in terms of currents in loops. That's what that ring is there, and it's in the presence of a magnetic field that will be the long vectors about which that loop is turning. And so one gets a torque, meaning a reorientation of the current carrying wires in the presence of magnetic fields. That was our first, in the sequence of our physics courses, our first exposure to this idea of magnetic moments. And so the tau in physics 1220 for current carrying wires in magnetic fields becomes I times A cross B, where B is the magnetic field, I is the current, and A is a vector, a surface vector of the area that my current wire loop describes. So one could leave it at that, but one doesn't. Instead, one introduces a new vector that is equal to I times A vector. I believe the symbol is usually mu, and I think that's what is written there. It's just in a color that's hard to read on here. So this becomes then mu cross b, therefore mu times b times sine theta, and this mu is what is called the magnetic moment. And in wire loops, in circuitry, it has this intuitive meaning, I times A, but if one doesn't have that, then if there is no wire that carries a current, one can still introduce the same quantity. And essentially, on average, in say a 1s state, the electron in hydrogen behaves like as if it was in a wire loop that's circular. And the radius of that loop describes this. Is described by this A vector. Its orientation and its magnitude can be described by that A vector. And so that is how one transfers this idea now to our spinning electrons in our atomic physics. And it's immediately clear that the magnetic moments are very different whether I spin an electron about itself, then I have a small area described by the A vector, or whether I spin it about the whole freaking atom at this huge distance from the nucleus, that is a very large area in comparison, maybe 10,000 times larger or so, and correspondingly there are very different, possibly very different amounts of angular momenta involved for the spinning and for the orbital. All right, at that point the lecture runs out, so that was this lecture.